Accession number 10167, reel 3.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 3. You were telling me why you thought you'd failed or not done too well on the Octu course.
I suppose I was still a callow youth, fairly inexperienced, for one thing. I was showing my working class experience, I suppose, for another.
In what way?
Well, I dare say that my etiquette and table manners weren't perhaps up to a scratch, and this was something that, of course, was being observed at the time. And I know, I guess I did quite well in the actual intelligence test, etc., as far as I could judge. But I did come a copper with the practical side, so perhaps they were right in that. I think subsequently I was able to show leadership, if that was something that perhaps they faulted me on. But it was all part of the final exercise was a test in leadership and appreciation of practical problems, and I don't know that. I was told subsequently that I could apply if I wanted to. That obviously wasn't something that was totally impossible, that they clearly thought that I was a marginal case and they would give me another try at it if I wanted to.
Did you want to be an officer at the time? Were you disappointed?
No, I don't think I wanted to be an officer. I don't think I was too disappointed.
Why didn't you want to be an officer?
There was this feeling that young officers were likely to be cannon fodder, and this was certainly something that was borne out subsequently, but I think we all knew it there at that point in time. And I was quite happy with what I was doing. I was in with a gang of people who I thought were my intellectual mates, and I was keen to be part of this group. So I was, as far as being in the army is concerned, this is as good a place I thought that I could wish to be. So I was quite happy with the situation.
You were training at Warwick for, I think you said, 14 weeks.
Uh-huh.
What happened then? Was there any final exam?
Yes, we had to pass a final exam in all of the different areas. And this included being proficient in buzzer testing and lamp, and as I say, I really wasn't all that good. But somehow or other, they passed me. And on a certain day, we were told that we had become qualified signatures, and this was entered up in one's AB64 and so forth. And then we had to wait a while. I mean, we had celebrations and all this sort of thing, and then we had to wait a while to be told where we were going to be posted to. Now, the subsequent experience would have been, most people appreciated that it was just a question then of waiting until you were sent overseas to active service. I mean, no one thought that there was going to be any more in than that. So wherever one went, it was just a question of time before you went overseas into some sort of war situation, presumably. And what was the disquieting was that we'd got ourselves a group. We were great friends and pals, and they would be all broken up, generally speaking, which was largely what happened. People that I was particularly close to went off somewhere else, you know.
Now, you were attached to the Leicestershire Regiment, and...
No, I was in the Leicestershire Regiment.
And at what point did you go to, is it Horncastle in Lincolnshire?
Yes, now, at that stage, I was told that I'd been posted to Horncastle with the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and I think perhaps I may have misled you on reflection. What it was, I was in the Leicestershire Regiment, and I had the Leicestershire Camp Badge, which was a sort of a line, I think, something like that. And I was attached to the Royal Warwickshire, and there was a Royal Warwickshire battalion that I was with. Its number I don't know, but it was based in Horncastle and in the villages around Horncastle. And it was a holding battalion, and its purpose really was to train people in advanced training and then just send them off in suitable batches overseas to various overseas postings. Now, I stayed there for a few months, and I think it was just luck. I mean, I could have been on any number of different drafts, but what happened was that at some point in time I finished up being an orderly room corporal, and that was a sort of an official post, and perhaps for that reason I missed one or two drafts. That was later on.
So you were in a signal section with this battalion?
I started off in the signal section, and what we were doing there mostly were actual proper training exercises.
What sort of thing would that entail?
There was one in particular, I think, which demonstrates what we were doing. We went up from Horncastle by lorry up to Farthingdales in the North Yorkshire Moors, and we did a proper training exercise with another battalion, sort of tactical battle exercise there. And I remember we travelled around the Yorkshire Dales for about 3 days and covered about 80 miles. So that was really, you know...
What were you actually doing during the time?
There would be an attacking force and a defending force, and one would go into tactical exercises with individual companies. You would be in a company with the wireless set and reporting back to a headquarters set. And you would be providing the communication network for those exercises, either defence or attack or whatever.
How reliable were you finding the telephones and the wireless in this sort of mock action tactics?
Shall I come to that later on? Because
fine, yes.
Yes,
okay.
Because that's much more important later on, I think.
Right.
When you get into the sort of true wartime experience.
How realistic did you think these exercises were?
As far as actual, that's the cat. As far as actually experiencing difficult and arduous conditions, they were very, very exacting. I mean, the weather was actually atrocious in Farthingdales. A little anecdote, which I think underlines this. We came back to some barracks at the end of the three-day exercise in Farthingdales, absolutely soaked. We were all told by a sergeant to put our things into a drying room, and they were pinched. Now, you know, we had spares, but these were denim trousers and things, and denim jacket. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. When I came back to the unit, I was put on a charge of having lost my equipment. And I thought this was most unfair, and I went before the commanding officer. And I told him that I was obeying a lawful order given to me by a sergeant who told me to put my things in the drying room, and therefore was his responsibility. And he went mad. That sort of logical exercise, of course, was quite anathema to the army. They were my items of equipment, and it was my responsibility. If I lost them, I was at fault. So I had to pay for them. He didn't put me into jankers or anything like that, but I had to pay for them, and I was most unhappy about that. I mean, that was symptomatic of the sort of stupid discipline situation that existed. But I was particularly incensed by that one. Most of the time you could see a mad logic in what they were doing, but I thought it was quite stupid. Because really, I thought that my case was quite strong, and therefore it didn't have any guts at all. He'd have said, all right, fair enough, I accept it, you know. But he didn't. I mean, he could see no farther than the fact that it was my stuff, and therefore I ought to have looked after it, and if I'd lost it, it was my fault, sort of thing. So what I was doing was turning the army system around against him, but he didn't. didn't go down that road at all. So on the level of sheer difficulty of working and of operating, yes, I think it was quite typical of what happened subsequently. And as I say, any hardship, any moving around on foot over large distances was very, very true to what happened, in fact, subsequently.
Now, you were acting as orderly corporal. You weren't actually a corporal at this time, were you?
I was a lance corporal, yes.
Were you actually promoted to that, or were you acting?
Yes, they made me. I was an acting lance corporal, I guess, yes. Just purely for the purposes.
Do you know what your duties were as orderly corporal? What your
one of them was sort of getting Jankers people, you know, anybody who was on Jankers. I had to give them jobs, and there were various jobs that had to be done, cookhouse duties and this sort of thing. So one had to... And, of course, the trouble about this sort of situation was that most of the time there was nothing much for people to do, those that were just hanging about, because... The exercises weren't on every day and weren't... You didn't have a set routine of things to do. What happened was that, say, the orderly corporal would find that somebody had a job to do, like moving tables from one place to another. So I would go in to a barrack room where there were a number of people not doing anything, bring them all out of there and get them onto jobs. So you were mostly doing just sort of labouring jobs, anything that sort of crops up. Because there were a lot of time that was just being wasted by people hanging around waiting for something to happen.
Did your relationship with the people you were with change as when you were promoted to lance?
Yes. Mind, the only person that I was... this is what happened in the army. You sort of made friends and lost them. This was one of the problems, unfortunately. So I'd lost a lot of friends, left them in Warwick. And one or two I made, one of them was a lance corporal with me, so I was all right with him sort of thing. And I really didn't have many friends elsewhere. But yes, there would have been problems because one had to make this distinction. I mean, it was always very difficult. This is one of the major problems, of course, of establishing authority, isn't it, that they give you a lance corporal position and you then have to order people around who previously were your peers. And part of the army system, of course, is that you can do this. But it also has not only to be a part of what is a nominal position, but you also have to have some authority in yourself to be able to do that. People have to accept that not only have you the nominal power to tell people what to do, but you've also got the temporal power to do it in yourself, that you've got the character to be able to impose your own will upon them.
And you didn't have any trouble?
Sometimes I did and sometimes I didn't. I mean, most of the time, really, it was very difficult. These were people, generally speaking, who were waiting to go abroad. They weren't awfully disposed to do as they were told. They weren't awfully conducive to authority, because there's very much... I mean, some of them could have been very awkward indeed and have been quite happy to go into glasshouses or whatever, you know, to get off drafts and so forth. So, I mean, I had very little to impose any authority upon those types of persons at all. So it wasn't easy, no. I eventually did it out of sheer goodness of heart, I guess. But I couldn't impose very much authority on them, but I did have quite a decent sergeant major who, at the last resort, would come along and kick them around if he wanted to, and he was a decent sort.
You eventually drafted in, I think it was June 1943.
Yes.
Did you get any embarkation leave before?
Yes. I think I'd had leave earlier as well, but everybody got embarkation leave of about a week, I think, something like that. You were generally given embarkation leave, and this was sort of the sugar to gild the pill, as it were. So you'd go home and tell people that you're off overseas, because, I mean, you weren't likely to be coming back very frequently after that. Otherwise, every so now and again, you I don't know what the sort of interval was, but if you were in England, every 2 or 3 months you were entitled to so many days leave or whatever. So the embarkation leave was in lieu of lots of opportunities subsequently. So you did get about 7 days, I think, or 10 days or whatever.
How did your parents react?
Well, they weren't very happy at all, of course. My father could see that I was very likely going into a dangerous situation. Mother too, I guess. So they weren't very sure that they would ever see me again, I guess. But
were there any special preparations made before you went? Or any special kit issued?
We got tropical kit, I think, if I recall properly.
You knew you were going to North Africa?
Oh, we knew we were going, yes, to North Africa, that was pretty sure. And we embarked at Liverpool on HMS Britannia, which was one of the very big troop ships. It was one of the old cruise liners, I guess, in better days. And it was an immense ship. I think we were on F deck. And
was it overcrowded?
Oh, yes. Thousands and thousands of people on board. And we went down, I think, about 4 or 5 flights of steps to get down to our sort of level. And we were quite certain that if there was any torpedoing being done, the quickest way out would have been through the torpedo hole rather than try to go upstairs, because we were so far below the waterline that we'd have been drowned in next to no time.
Sounds so, like you were very conscious of that.
Oh, yes, yes. It was very claustrophobic as well. And we were in hammocks, which sort of adds to it somehow or other. We had this sort of deck where there's possibly 100 or 200 people, I forget, quite a number anyway. And used to stow away the hammocks during the day and have your meals down there. And then at night you just put your hammocks up as best you could and sleep in the hammocks. And, you know, most people weren't used to hammocks, so there was all sorts of little problems that happened because of that, and accidents, people falling out of hammocks or being tipped out of hammocks. That was another little bit of fun and games that people had from time to time. But once you grow used to them, they were very comfortable, actually, and they have a beautiful movement when the ship moved.
Talking about ship's movement, did you have any problem with seasickness, or was it a problem amongst the troops?
There was some seasickness, and some people, of course, were very ill. But I wasn't too conscious on that journey of very much, although on other occasions there it was more evident, I think. But not on that one. We were so far down, I guess, I don't think we... And she was a very good mover. I don't think there were a great deal of lateral movement at all that I can recall. Although we went through the Bay of Biscay and that was inclined to be...
Did you get any opportunity to get out on deck for some exercise?
I don't know that there was any organised exercise, but one did go up on deck, you know, as much as you could. But as I say, it was quite a tidy run. There was a cinema on board, and I think we saw the films most of the time. It was a George Formby film, I think, that I saw about a dozen times, and it wasn't a very good one in the first place. We went along on the assumption that they might change it, but they never did. But it passed the time. I think we were away about 4 or 5. Well, I don't know how long would it be.
What route did you went round the Cape? Did you?
Yes. No, we went to North Africa. So
you went through the Mediterranean.
Yes, through the Mediterranean. Yes, we only went to Algiers about 11 days. 11 days. I'm trying to find what it was. We arrived in Algiers harbour, and that was really something. And Algiers from the sea looked wonderful. And of course it was beautifully sunny. And we just transferred from the Britannia to an American ship. It was just a sort of a freight ship. it was terribly overcrowded. I mean, if we thought the Britannia was overcrowded, this one was actually bristling with people. And there was a Yankee provisioned in everything. And the only item of interest there was that one had to queue for hours for meals. But when you got them, they were marvellous. They were Yankee meals. And I remember we used to queue for about 3 or 4 hours in the morning. And we finished it with a sort of a breakfast-lunch thing. And there were pancakes and porridge and sausages and eggs and meat and peaches and fruits. And we used to get them all on, you know, 2 mess tins. So they were quite happy. But it was even more overcrowded. But all that we were doing was just going down the coast of North Africa, I think, to somewhere further down, a place called Philippeville, and then we disembarked at Philippeville. I think we were in a transit camp there for a while and then embarked on a sort of a ride through Algeria to, or to be Tripoli, I suppose. That journey, we were with a sort of a group on a lorry of people that we'd grown used to, we'd come from England with, so there again was another opportunity to make friends. And I used to meet those people subsequently, because everyone else was in a totally different area of the war, but those you generally found were in the Mediterranean, those people that you met at that stage. One thing that we had to do was we had to scrub all our equipment white once we got into North Africa, after having blanked it for months and months prior in England. We had to scrub it naturally white, which was murder, and everybody was dead chuffed with that. So thereafter, all your equipment was white. And we were on this road journey, and it was quite interesting. We passed Constantine on a hill. I remember thinking that was beautiful. And stayed one night at a stop beside a ruin where there was a swimming pool, where I darn near drowned, because we went in over my depth and I wasn't a very good swimmer. But the real disturbing feature was that 2 members of the party found this shell which hadn't exploded and it blew up. And, one was killed and one was hurt. So that brought home to us that really, you know, we were going more and more nearer to a state of war, which was our first real taste, I think, of real life situations in
how
war.
How did you think you'd respond at this time, when you were just approaching trouble, so to speak? How did you think then that you would respond to active service? Did you think you were going to be cut out for it, or?
I didn't think I was cut out for it. I didn't see it as being. I was a natural man of action. One didn't know until later how you would react to actual war situations, whether you'd be able to stand up to the pressure of war. And all that one felt in these early stages, which really were nothing but just various aspects of the possibilities of what could happen, I think everyone was very apprehensive, really. Some part of it comes, I think, later on, being involved in the true state of affairs, then you get supported. It was a question of getting into an environment. But I don't think there's any real connection between training situations and the real thing, you see. This is the point. Anything else is just playing at it.
So you were moving along the coast of North Africa, I mean.
Yeah.
And where were you heading?
We finished up at Sousse, which is on the coast, I think. Tripolitania, whatever it was at that time. I forgot what it was. And Where we were bound for, of course, was Sicily, although someone probably was planning it all, but we were at this transit camp at Sousse beforehand, and then at a suitable time, 12th of July, we embarked on troop-carrying craft to proceed to Sicily.
Did you know then that you'd been posted to the 9th DLI? Or
well, it didn't happen until some days later, actually. Because, I guess, it wasn't until we got to Sicily that they did actually allocate people to specific units. Presumably, there had been the proper invasion of Sicily some days before that. We weren't there, of course, at the actual landing. We were there some time afterwards, but it hadn't been long before, so I guess the invasion of Sicily was some time before that. And we landed in the south, a place called Avola, I think, which was perfectly quiet. The front was some way further north. And it was some days, I guess, before we caught up with the 9th DLI. At some point in time, obviously, there had been some allocation of people to battalions. And
did you find out before you actually joined them? Or did you just join them and then were told you were...
I think we were told beforehand. So we were in a sort of a transit area and we were told beforehand. And it was this transit area, funny enough, that we saw Monty. We were just hanging about. We weren't doing anything. We were at the side of this road and this jeep comes bowling past. And typical of Monty, he stopped to chat to us. Thin face with a very high-pitched voice. Bags of confidence. Asked us who we were and what we were doing. Give him a real good salute. Cheered him up no end. And so we asked him, how are we doing, sir? And he said, oh, well, which was true, that they were rather held on the British front. Things weren't going quite so fast there, but that the Americans were doing this marvellous pincer movement on the western side, and that Sicily would be taken within 2 or 3 weeks. And then you can all go back to England, he said. So we said, oh, thank you very much, sir. Of course, he didn't know that we'd just come from England. he thought we were the 50th Division, which was all part of what happened subsequently. So that was Monty. You know, off he gave us some fags and off he bowled along in his jeep again.
Were you impressed by him, or not impressed, or what did you think?
I think, thanks though, yes, he gave the impression of confidence. And we were in the sort of Monty-type situation where people were being told what they were doing, which was part and parcel of what he was after. But a little bit later on, of course, a lot of that glitter was really being stripped away from him and become more obvious that he was a bit of a con man, in effect. And there was the beginnings of feeling that they were rumbling him.
Well, we'll come to that later, because I'm quite interested in that. How you told you were joining the 9th DLI. How did you feel about that? Because that's more your part of the country.
Yes, I wasn't unhappy about that. I didn't see what the hell I was doing with the Leicestershire Regiment. As long as I was going to be in some county regiment, I was quite happy to be in the 9th. And, of course, it was the 50th Division, and they had this very good reputation in North Africa, in the desert. So, I mean, they had a lot of glamour attached to them, and I was quite happy. The unfortunate part about it was that I couldn't go into the signals section as such. So I just went into a platoon, but as a platoon signaller, which didn't amount to very much, because they hardly used them at all. So that was disappointing, and that aspect of it was quite worrying, because, I mean, at that point in time, I was just an ordinary infantryman.
Now, you joined them on the 19th of July,
yep.
I think, 1943. Do you remember which company and platoon you were put into?
I was in 11 platoon.
And which company would that be in?
B company, I should think, or not? B. Sure. B.
What sort of reception
depends upon
did you
where
get?
They started one, really.
What sort of reception did you get when you joined them? And where, in fact, were they? So I should have pointed out where were they and what reception did they give you?
They were... It was in the area of the Primosoli Bridge in Sicily, which was one of their major battles. It was one of the Durham's toughest battles in Sicily, and they had